Welcome everyone to the talk about CubeSats. What's this CubeSat stuff anyhow? How many of you already have a vague idea about CubeSats? Okay, that's a fair few people. First, a little bit about me. I'm Bout Wechelaar, he, him, and I worked on a university satellite called Delphi C3, and that's where my space career started. I'm an RF engineer, so radio frequency, also network and security at the spin-off IsoSpace. My radio amateur call sign is Papa Alpha 3 Whiskey Echo Golf. Most people don't pronounce it that way, but that's the habit of amateur radio, to spell every individual letter. I own a spacecraft with my non-profit, of which I and a few people are the owners, but I am the one that signed for it, so technically I own a spacecraft. And I'm also a sound engineer, videographer, and all-around nutter with technical stuff and electronics. And I'm rarely angry, but always an angry nerd. So I end up in a podcast every once in a while, you might have heard of, called Angry Nerds. Contents of this talk, basically I'm going into what is a satellite, what makes it special, what makes space special, why do we do these CubeSat things, and some typical applications. Disclaimer for the space nerds in the room, I'm going to simplify a lot because it's too much to fit in one small talk. This is not a corporate talk. I'm not here to promote my employer, but I have been borrowing a lot of their slides, pictures, so thank you very much, IsoSpace, for doing this. This is the only slide I will have that talks about the company. But yeah, we started in 2006 with a couple of friends as a spin-off from the TU Delft. And now we are quite a big player in the field, with 130 people running around, launching a lot of stuff. Over 700 satellites have been launched by our company, and that's also third parties that contract us to do the launching part. So what's a satellite in the first place? There's two types of satellites. One is a natural satellite, basically something orbiting something else, and with something I mean an astronomical body. So a bit of rock or gas or whatever it is orbiting something else. The moon orbiting the Earth is a satellite. We usually call that satellite zero in our language, because it's the one that was there first, so we start at zero, just like programmers. And we also are orbiting ourselves around the sun, so technically we are a satellite of the sun, and even galaxies can orbit other galaxies, so that was also a satellite. In this talk, I'm mostly going to talk about the second one, artificial satellites. So an object that we created as mankind and placed it in an orbit around a celestial body. Can be the Earth. Most of this talk is about the Earth, but it can also be something else. Moon, Mars, something very far away. So yeah, in this talk, it's a synonym for spacecraft. It's not exactly rocket science. What's so special about space, or is it? Space projects are different in a few ways. You get to serial production, but you never quite get to a factory. We don't have enough volume to actually have a factory. Well, some companies are now getting there, and they're getting closer and closer. But the main thing is, you can't easily fix stuff. Once it's there, it's there. You can get there with, for instance, the space shuttle, or could in the past. Very expensive, so that's only possible if you have a lot of money to fix it, because the original problem is so expensive to fix later than that is worth it. Yeah, and if you send something to an asteroid and it takes several years to get there, and then it stops phoning home, yeah, that's a problem. So you have to think about this. And we humans are really good in problem solving. This is from Apollo 13. I don't know who has seen the movie or knows about this, but most people do. We have to make that square thing fit into a round hole with nothing but whatever there was in the capsule at the time. And we figured out a way to do it. I radioed that up to the astronauts, And one of the first steps was take the flight handbook and rip the cover, because we need the cover. The flight handbook we don't need anymore because everything went wrong anyway. But we don't want to get that close anymore to that kind of disaster. So we want to test again. Software, hardware, environment. And with environment, I'm going to go into each one in a bit of, in some slides. End-to-end testing and sometimes fault tree analysis. And most of the times, that's actually a pretty big part for traditional space, but we'll get into that. There's also challenges on the ground before launch. So this seems very trivial, but that satellite fell off its launch adapters, or there's the white part. That's basically there to tilt the satellite from horizontal to vertical. And when they found out, like, oh yeah, we need to tilt it, somebody just pressed the button, should tilt. And then somebody remembered they borrowed the bolts for another project. And it fell over, and that got launched in the end, by the way. They fixed it, checked it, was very expensive, but they could still launch it. So there's also ground handling and logistics. You have to make sure that you know everything what you've done on the ground to make sure it doesn't break in space. Gravity sounds obvious, but if you have something that's supposed to extend, like a solar panel that needs to fold out, how do you simulate that on Earth? Because the gravity is there. The only way to not have it is either go in a parabolic flight in an airplane and just dive down and do your test. And if that's unfeasible, you need to suspend stuff or figure out how to make friction less. Or it's very difficult to get rid of the gravity for testing. Cleanliness is another thing. If you have a fingerprint on the lens and you launch it and it's like, ooh, nice, I have a fingerprint on my lens. Or in the case of Hubble Space Telescope, they found out it needs glasses because it's not seeing very well. And they went up, that's the exception for a very expensive fix, went up, put an extra lens on there just to make it see right. And mistakes happen, obviously. First thing is getting there in one piece. So when you light the rocket, it always looks so peaceful from a distance because you don't get to see the vibration up close, but it's a very, very violent event. And you have to think about this with stiffness, strength, vibration dampening. So can I stop this thing from rattling? It needs to be shockproof. When you light a solid rocket, for instance, it starts from standing still to going very quickly. So that's quite a big shock. The other one is if you have stage separation, so one part of the rocket gets ejected because it's done, and that is typically done with explosive bolts, so they literally explode the bolts that keep everything together so it separates. That gives a shock through the whole system, and you need to test for that. Acoustic loading, it's very loud. For the people that have a bit of a grasp on decibels, it's about 200 decibels audio. And cleanliness again. So for the first one, vibration testing, we stick a satellite on a vibration table and we basically start shaking it. I have a video of this. It's quite noisy, so I'm first going to explain what's going to happen. This is the table, and that's going to go up and down to test in one axis what will happen if I vibrate this thing. And then we ramp up the frequency at which it rattles, and we try to find where it really wants to resonate. So this is basically to see, like, if this thing resonates, where does it resonate and does it break? After that, you're going into another thing, which is basically sort of shocking, so it's more amplitude. It's basically more violent. And this is quite noisy, so when I start the video, that's why I'm explaining it now. I'm gonna play the video, and then you'll hear first the cooling start up, and then listen to the pitch of the sound where it ramps up this frequency. And I've cut the video in slices because it's a really long test. So it starts out quite slowly, and you can hear stuff already starting to shake. And then you increase the frequency, and at some point the camera doesn't pick it up anymore. So it starts to feel like it's standing still. It's still going the same amplitude as before. And now it's done, and now it's going to do the violent one. And then it's done. And this is in one axis, and then you basically twist it around and do it again. And again, and on all three axes. And then you rattle it again to see if anything changed. So you basically rattle it first, you find out where it rattles, what frequencies it rattles, and then you do the violent one, and you do everything again, and you compare notes. You say, okay, if something has changed internally, then it rattles at a different frequency. And obviously you can open the box and see, is it still in one piece? Radiation testing, we don't typically do that. There is a lot of radiation in space, but it's not as bad as many people think. You can check what materials you use. You can check shielding, so shielding the radiation from entering your electronics, for instance. Built-in redundancies. But yeah, like I said, it's not that bad as many people think. There's two types of radiation. There's single events where something just hits and upsets something. And there's the total ionizing dose, where it's just getting bombarded all the time, and over years it starts to become radioactive, basically. So stuff that comes back out of space is usually radioactive. Then there's vacuum. You also need to take that into account. What materials do I use? Is that outgassing? So in vacuum, everything that you have put inside a material can actually vent out. A famous experiment is putting a marshmallow in vacuum, and it sort of swells up because all the air in the marshmallow wants to go out. Component selection, so can this thing work in vacuum? For the electronics people, electrolytic condensers, capacitors, will basically explode because they are made to not keep their liquid in, but gracefully explode when there's something wrong. Well, if you put vacuum, they open and release all the electrolyte. Heat transfer, so how do I get the heat out? There's no air, so you can't put a fan on stuff because there is no air to move it. Lubrication of things, if you put a bit of oil on something, then the oil will just disappear because, yeah, vacuum sucked it away. And component placement, so do I face something on the outside, do I tuck it in, do I make a box that's actually at atmospheric pressure? And coupled to that, there's also temperature differences. What materials can I use? Do I need gaskets, interfaces? Do I need to thermally insulate something to keep it at one temperature, or do I want to have heat extracted from it? That kind of stuff you all have to take into account. And to actually test that, you need to do some testing. Is it really that bad? Well, two examples. The Funky-1 satellite is in low Earth orbit. It's actually not that bad. Outside surfaces, minus 22 to 31 degrees. That's really not bad. The internal temperatures are even nicer, minus 9 to plus 20. So what's the fuss about? Well, the other one, Chang'e 4, that's a Chinese spacecraft that I'll have a few slides on at the end of the presentation. Went a bit further, and then the outside gets minus 90 to plus 120, and the internal surfaces get minus 10 to plus 45. And some of these things are counted when the power is on. And if the power shuts off, then things get really cold, and you have to make sure that you can start up again. So you do thermal vacuum testing. This is a vacuum chamber. I'm there on the left. So that gives you a bit of a scale of this chamber. This is a rather large one for a CubeSat. And then you put the CubeSat in, and you basically pump the air out and start doing your testing. Then the elephant out of this world, space junk. There's, of course, a lot of stuff there. This image is showing all the dots are individual tracked pieces around the Earth that we know of. There's a lot of stuff we don't know, but these individual dots are actually things that radars are picking up. So there's a lot of stuff there. CubeSats are small and easy to burn up in the atmosphere, so they're not an immediate hazard to fall on somebody's head, roof, whatever. saving fuel and materials is nice because they're lightweight, so you don't need that much fuel. You can make a rapid development possible. Looking up makes us aware of what's down, so space in that sense is nice because most people that look back at Earth are like, oh, this is a really precious place that we should protect. But you shouldn't build stuff in space that you can do on Earth. There's a lot of applications where satellites are just not the right solution. We should not unnecessarily pollute space. The resources are finite, and yeah, we need to be a good space citizen. And sometimes stuff blows up. But yeah, we're learning a lot from those events, but we also need to take care that this doesn't happen that often. And then once you're in space, there's also still the option of that debris hitting you. Micrometeorites is one of these things. On the left, there's an image of a solar panel, and on the right at the arrow, you can see a dent in it. There's something that went into it. And such a hole, even if it's a rather big hole, can be caused by something really small, because there's a lot of energy in a collision. Okay, that was a brief introduction. Now on to the CubeSat parts, and I'm going to also look at the time, because I need to hurry up a bit. So CubeSats, what are these CubeSats? There's a couple of sources that have information on what's a CubeSat. There's a lot of stuff. Don't read all of that. It's just to say there's a lot of differing long-worded things, and this is not even that big. It's a 10 by 10 centimeter cube with a maximum mass of 1.3 kilos. And then there's a lot of other stuff, and you can build units out of it. I brought one. So this is a one unit CubeSat. 10 by 10 by 10 centimeters. And then you can, if you want to make a larger satellite, you just start adding blocks to it. And depending on the application, you pick a size. The bigger the size and the bigger the mass, the more you need to pay for launch. So that's why such a small one is nice. And then you get to this slide with all the size. So it starts with educational ones. That's the one you CubeSats. Then there was a project called QB50 that needed a 2U. And then, yeah, these are all the sizes up. And then you end up with the 16U, which is Earth observation missions where the instrument doesn't fit. And the text also doesn't fit in the box. But yeah, there's all these different sizes that are an optimum choice for a particular project. You mean this one? Or in general, this is the smallest one you get. It's a 1U. And 3U is basically those. And then, of course, we're nerds. So we, for April Fools, we released the Tetris CubeSats. And the Bohr Cube, we also calculated what kind of CubeSat it is. It's a 27 times 10 to the power of 9U CubeSat. For, of course, galactic domination and assimilation. Resistance is futile if smaller than 1 ohm. So what were these CubeSats in the first place for? What was the purpose? What did we want to change? Well, traditional space missions are entirely custom. So having something like this is quite a new concept. They used to make satellites by just throwing stuff together, and then the size is whatever you end up with. There's a lot of trade-offs between size, mass, what it needs to do, etc. But traditionally, you buy the entire rocket. And then you have a lot of paperwork. You need to talk to the rocket manufacturer, and you say, OK, this is what we're going to do. That's actually quite costly. And we figured, why not make a standard so that you can say, it's one of them. And then it will say, oh, OK, yeah, now then I know what it is. And it's, yeah, so it's different by the mission requirements of whoever is buying the rocket. And yeah, the fuel type of the rocket, launch vehicle type, what kind of vibration profile do you get? All these tests and stuff that I mentioned before are tailored to that rocket. So that slows innovation down quite a lot, because every project needs to go from A to Z and get entirely designed in cooperation with people. So what if we ride share? So we just tag along with someone else. Someone buys a rocket, they say, okay, I can take 1,000 kilos up to space, but my satellite weighs 900, so I have 100 kilos left. So who is interested to buy that? The other thing is, a rocket needs to be balanced. So the center of gravity of the rocket needs to be in the middle of center of mass. It needs to be in the middle of the rocket, otherwise it will shift one way or the other. And they can correct that with a lot of propellant, so burning fuel. But it's better to balance it properly. So sometimes they would literally stick blocks of lead or another heavy material on the rocket to balance it. And then we said, can we just give you this and tell you what it weighs? And you stick it on there, and this is just a box with a couple of springs in it. I say just a box. One of my colleagues is going to kill me if I tell him it's just a box, because his entire life is in this thing. But yeah, it's in essence, it's a box with a spring, and then that gets mounted up to the rocket at the right spot, the precise right spot, and it balances out perfectly, and you fill this with satellites. And the other benefit for the rocket operator is it isolates the satellite builders completely from the rocket. The rocket people know this thing weighs that much. And importantly, the doors stay closed while we launch. So if whatever is in here gets destroyed, we're going to release the dust when we want that, but not earlier. So we keep this thing closed until it's time to open it. And that makes it a lot easier, because now they say, okay, it's a block, and you have to tell them a bit about what's inside. They don't want dangerous goods in there, but bananas. Oh, bananas, yeah. We could fill one. Yeah, we also once thought that four satellites in one. One of those tubes actually fits a champagne bottle rather well. But yeah, never materialized. So back to that philosophy. Develop quickly. Short lifespan, typically 1 year, and it's now getting to 3 to 5 years. That's actually, people want more reliable stuff, and we can now give them more reliable stuff because we've been trying a bit, and we know that stuff works. Typically, it's low Earth orbit with quick re-entry. Like I said earlier, be a good space citizen. If you shoot your stuff up, and it's only going to last 5 years, don't keep it up there for 20. It's a bit of a waste of that stuff there. So we launch it low, it burns up quicker, etc. So traditional space missions are mostly based on standardized stuff from the past, lessons learned, a lot of design criteria, minimal risk, and we take a bit of more risk. And it's all off-the-shelf stuff for us, as far as off-the-shelf goes. These satellites typically contain automotive or regular industrial parts, and not space-qualified stuff. And afterwards, I'm probably going to go somewhere and display this somewhere. If you want to have a look, feel free. So quicker, quicker, quicker. And then somebody made this CubeSat design spec. I'm going really quickly through this. It's basically, here's the standard, and we have all these things in it, and it becomes really complicated. So then you got the satellite part figured out, and then it became easier, and then we made a standard, and then it became more difficult. What? So we are basically going back to simpler, and you need to really make sure that you apply the right amount of standardization for the right type of project. So make it simple if it needs to be simple, make it difficult if it needs to be difficult, but don't make it difficult if it can be easy. So you end up with hardware in the terms of, well, boards, and you stack them into a frame. So this frame is actually exactly this frame, and not even a copy, no, it's that one. And the top one is Delphi C3, that was what I worked on at the university. So you start with that, but you have to test it first. So you build a flat set, that's called a flat set, it's because it's flat and not a cube. So yeah, it's breadboarding, typical breadboarding. All the people in electronics know, like, this gets out of hand quickly. This is a rather nice picture when we were still, well, semi-organized. And then you start adding an analyzer, and you end up with a whole lab full of stuff. Not really important to see all the parts, but the point is that this is just any regular electronics R&D development, but sometimes that hardware actually goes to space. That's called protoflight. It's prototype goes to flight. And yeah, you have to be careful because this thing might fly. So yeah, start with a drawing, refine the drawing, and then stack it up in the clean room. Clean it first, of course. Stack all of these things up, stick it in a frame, and then launch. And then you have this standard. And then most of these actually didn't comply to the standard. So why did we set the standard in the first place? So the first 6-unit CubeSat was actually not a 6-unit, but was slightly bigger. Planet Labs' first satellite, Dove 1, was actually an inch longer because they took the specification of 30, which was a 3U, 30 centimeters, and they said, oh, we need 1 inch more. Inch, yes. So we have 30 centimeters plus 1 inch. And then we had another satellite, Naive 1, which is basically this size, and it has some stuff in a place where it previously said you can't put stuff there. Well, we did, and it fit in the launcher, so it was fine. So most of them are non-compliant, and you would say, okay, what's the easiest thing to do out of this whole specification? Well, you would be sure that it actually fits in the rails, right, in this box. Well, 40% of the people on a particular project actually failed already on that. It just didn't fit the box. Like, okay, interesting. So yeah, is that a problem? Well, if you cannot accommodate for it, it's not. So you just continue and figure out how to solve that. And then the CubeSats became a bigger thing and a bigger thing, and now this thing, Hera, is on the way to an asteroid with two of those boxes that I highlighted in red. It's the half version of this, so this is 4 doors, and there's 2 doors in that. We call that the Deep Space Deployer. This thing is on the way to an asteroid, it's off, and it needs to work in, I don't know how long it takes for it to get there, and then deploy 2 satellites around that asteroid. So from R&D to economies of scale. Again, this is a picture of Planet Labs. That's the satellite that we launched that was 1 inch bigger. And they built a few. They basically built them so quickly, testing in production, etc. They started building them and stacking them up, saying, OK, launch these, please, thank you. And then we were sticking them in those blue boxes and launching them. And then they were in space and they learned stuff. And they were like, oh, the ones that are stuck there, can you just give them back for a week? Because we're going to change something. And they keep innovating and keep iterating the design. And now they have a really reliable fleet of satellites. So some of the mission types that you typically see, this slide has a lot of them. Top left, ship tracking services, where is my ship and my cargo? Space research, so basically just the astronomy parts of space research. Telecommunications, talking to people, education and training. Earth sciences, so that's mostly looking at the Earth and in a scientific way. That's not the same as Earth observation and, for instance, agricultural monitoring. So Earth observation is looking at the Earth for something you know, and Earth sciences is we're doing science on the Earth. We're studying things that we don't understand yet. Microgravity research, pipeline monitoring, aircraft tracking is also interesting. Climate monitoring, big topic right now. I skipped signal intelligence. I'll have a slide about that. Some of these I have slides about, and technology validation. That last one is basically, I have something that I built for a space mission and I want to fly it before I build the whole big spacecraft around it. That's going to cost me a lot of money. So here's my small thing that I want to test. Fly it, tell me if it works. I'm going to go quickly through a few of these slides. Did all of you or some of you who did know that we built and design launch spacecraft as amateurs just to check out things and build stuff. The only one. Okay. So yeah, there are people that are designing and launching and building CubeSats for fun. I say fun, but it's obviously, it's a hobby, but to also educate yourself. And also for educational purposes, so to show people that. Amateur radio satellites are called orbiting satellites carrying amateur radio, or OSCARs. And the oldest one, OSCAR 1, was basically, top left image, something that they bolted onto another rocket as a mass dummy to indeed balance the rocket. So technically, although it wasn't a CubeSat, it was that concept that they started all that way back. Then OSCAR 7 got launched in 1974 and is still operational and working. That's actually a whole entirely different topic. But that's the oldest satellite that we have. It actually predates Voyagers in terms of launch. That still works. Largest was OSCAR 40, 450 kilogram, really big satellite, but unfortunately that failed on orbit due to an explosion in a propellant tank. Many CubeSats are university CubeSats. They end up in the radio amateur spectrum for educational purposes. I've worked on a few. This is a list of satellites that I've been involved in. Some of them are not even a CubeSat. This is what they call microsatellites. It's that big. So something like 30 centimeters, but then this is a meter high or something. And those are things that we all did as hobby projects, so I'm not getting paid for that. And then you can communicate with people through transponder of those satellites, but you can also listen to them to listen to the telemetry, get all the data. What's the battery voltage? How cold is it? Is there anything interesting? Do you get sunlight on your solar panels? How fast are you spinning? These things we can all decode and look at ourselves. But the bent pipe transponder is basically a popular option. You send a signal up to the satellite with your little radio, and it just gets relayed back down on another frequency. That's a technical thing, but it basically just copies whatever you send to it down to Earth. And I have a bit of a live demo here. You will first hear some telemetry. Unfortunately, there's no subtitles in English, but there's a bit of Dutch commentary, but I'll explain what's happening. But we're going to receive first the telemetry, and then you're going to hear some words from this transponder. But yeah, radio amateurs are quite used to bad sound quality, so I'm hoping that you can all hear what's being said. Yeah, so the sound that you're hearing is the data from the satellite. And you can actually hear the data, but you normally look at it with a computer. And now we're getting... So that's people talking, having a chat with each other through a satellite that's orbiting the Earth with stuff that you can bring to a grass field and just have fun and talk to whoever is in the footprint. The biggest footprint we have is a geostationary satellite. It's quite far away, and it covers almost half the planet. And I can talk to somebody in Antarctica, actually, that's just there in a research station, and I can just have a chat with that person directly. No phone lines, no IP, nothing. Just satellite there. We both see the satellite, we point the antennas, and we have a chat, which is really cool. And what you just listened to was all done with these three boards that we designed in our spare time. That went into a frame. I put some technical details because we're at the Hacker Hotel after all. It's quite a simple single microcontroller thing, and the rest is all analog stuff. So the radio parts, they're all traditional, old-fashioned radio things. Nothing clever there, other than being extremely power efficient. And then there's a computer running, and that's managing the whole thing. The computer takes 3 milliamps on 343, and that's it, and it runs on 3 milliamps. And there's a command receiver, so you can actually talk to this thing and make it do stuff. And then that transmitter that sends the data down, and that communication transponder. And that's all in here, because that's actually this what this is. And then you have a USB stick that you stick in your computer, and then you can receive the telemetry from it. Who here has heard about SDR, software-defined radio? Quite a few people. Okay, so when this dongle was designed for our project, which is designed in around 2010, we didn't have SDRs commercially available yet. You couldn't buy even the DVB sticks that you can reprogram yet. So this was a design from scratch from us to make sure that people could easily get a software-defined radio in their hands. And it's basically a sound card. You know, you plug it in, it shows up as a sound card, and you can do all kinds of fancy stuff. And now it's normal, but then it wasn't. Ground segment, someone needs to receive these satellites. In Delphi C3, in the university, we pioneered a ground network. So we basically told everybody, listen to this signal, get us the data, send us the data. That was quite new. In a commercial world, they've been doing that for years, but they pay a lot with it, and you get these really big tracking dishes. And then we said to them, oh, by the way, we have 350 people in our network, so we don't need a big dish. We just have a lot more people listening, so we can send slower. And then stuff works. We did it again with FunCube in 2013. We had 1,000 stations, and then a lot of commercial companies were getting nervous. They were like, these amateur dudes are just doing our business, but much better. So many others followed, SAT NOGS or SAT NOGS, TinyGS, that's a LoRa-based receiver. And then a lot of new commercial networks started spinning up, saying like, oh, we can also do this. Ah, good. So they all caught up now. And now you get cloud-based stuff, and you can basically rent this as a service if you want. But I prefer my old-fashioned dashboards that you build yourself on top of some stuff you build yourself. And then you look at this, and at launch, you're like, okay, I'm going to have a look, and all these things should turn green and stuff. I did build this dashboard about half a day before launch, because you're like, oh, we don't have a dashboard yet. Okay, now there's a dashboard. The outreach part, old to young, unfortunately, mostly the older people get into this. We really are working on getting more into the youth education with all these projects. And it does exist. The top middle picture is a school in the UK that got a class from one of our team members. I was there as well, not in this picture, but I was there explaining, giving this talk basically to kids. But this happened on the same day as launch, because BBC told us, oh, you're going to do education? We found a school for you. So we did the talk on the same day as launch, and we were all very tired, but it went really well. Okay, now to some other examples. Earth observation, AMS, is a satellite that is looking at agricultural applications for an infrared telescope. And that's I'm looking at this, this looks like a 12U. It's not in my slides. So that's 12 units, so it's basically two units in X and Y, and then stacked up three high. So you get basically to 20 by 20 by 30 centimeters. And then you can put a camera in it and look at, for instance, fields. Like, is this radiating any heat? And I'll have a slide a bit further on to show you what that actually tells you. Enabling remote communication. This is now mostly that people know as Starlink or an Iridium satellite phone. That already existed, but the satellites are getting smaller. Then another one, which we're particularly proud of, is the Netherlands-China Low Frequency Explorer, or NCLE. That was basically a project that we did in cooperation with China. And there was a trade mission to China where the king basically said, I think this is important for the Netherlands. Let's do it. And then we got to go ahead for this mission. To look at certain radio radiation that you can only detect when you're not on Earth. Because in this graph, you can see that at the top, the atmospheric opacity, so what can you see from the Earth, and C is also here in this case, over all the wavelengths. And there's all the way at the end, there's basically a bit that says like you can't hear this. There's no way that you can receive stuff on Earth from these sources. But we are making a lot of noise over there. So if you put a spacecraft around the Earth, you will just hear Earth. All the noise coming from also these events and stuff, it all adds up. We are a loud planet. So you need to shield stuff away from the Earth. So we look into that and we block the radio waves coming from the Earth by putting the moon in between, because then there's no noise. Why do we want to do that? Well, in the history of the universe, we had the Big Bang, and then there's a whole bunch of time that we call the Dark Ages, where we actually have no clue what happened. And the reason for that is, if you have the Doppler effect, which is basically the ambulance sound shifting when it passes you, what happens if an ambulance passes you? You hear the sound go down, because it's going away from you. Yeah. So the downshift is in sound, but it also happens to light, it happens to radio waves. And because there was a big explosion at the beginning of the universe, everything is moving away from us. So everything gets shifted down. So if you want to look into the past, you need to actually look downwards in frequency, and light becomes radio waves. And the further it's away from you, the lower that frequency gets. So we're now looking into all these really low frequency things. And unfortunately, the Earth is very noisy. So that's why we put the moon in between, so we can listen to this far away, distant transmissions, if you will, from that time. And they call it the Dark Ages because we don't know yet what happens, but we're going to find out. That got built partially as a CubeSat. It's not the size of a CubeSat, but the philosophy. So stack boards into an enclosure, make it a nice box. Top left is basically how people want to see it in traditional space. Closed aluminium box, all the connectors on the outside, your problem, make it happen. And then inside, we can use CubeSat parts. We can stack stuff in frames like we used to, and then just mount it in that box. You need a couple of antennas, 5 meter long carbon fiber. My colleague Ralph is standing at the end. That's a carbon fiber curved antenna that's very thin, and we can reel it in. It's basically flexible enough to put it on the spool and store it in this configuration. These are three antennas on the plate. And then you need to test all that stuff. And again, CubeSat philosophy. Build everything on a flat set, stick it into the box, test it, test it, test it. And then the most funny one, the gravity one. How do we test if these antennas roll out in zero G? Well, you calculate how much the antennas would see in terms of flexing, and you stick helium balloons on the end. You just calibrate a couple of helium balloons with a scale and then compensate for gravity that way. So this is our warehouse where we normally have all the in and outgoing shipments, and they said, okay, we need the space because we're going to put some antennas on there, 5 meters long each. We're going to reel them out, and yeah, there's going to be balloons. So it's going to be a big party, and then afterwards we could pop the balloons and have fun. Yeah. And then deliver to the Chinese to put that on their spacecraft, get it launched. So it launched on a Long March 4 from China in 2018. And then you have this camera that we got back from the Chinese. This is the main spacecraft. And then this is the antenna box. Trust me, it's the antenna box. And then you see the moon and the Earth in the picture. And this is really awesome to get back, like your hardware is sitting further away than the sun at the moment, because, or actually between the sun and the moon. So you get the illumination from the sun, and then you have the moon and Earth in view, which is really awesome. In China, the space program is run by the military, so we don't trust them. So you get all the data in hex printouts on paper, because no USB sticks or data transfers or nothing, because Chinese military. So you leave there with a briefcase of hex prints, and then you OCR all the hex prints, and then stick them in, I think it might have been Excel even, and out you get the plots. Unfortunately, we're still waiting for some of the data, so this is all we can show. Moving on to some Earth observation. I see Ad at the front row looking at this timing. I'm getting quite close, but this is really cool. Earth observation. So looking at the Earth. A cost-effective way of taking nice images of the Earth. And CubeSats are especially good because you can put a lot of them there and have rapid updates. We have telescopes that are really good. You get like really nice zoomed-in Google Maps, etc. That's all awesome. But those you see every year maybe a new picture, and then you're looking, oh, is my backyard already updated? Or did they finally remove the new building? Was it done, etc.? But sometimes you want to have quick data, and it doesn't matter if it's a bit blurry, but get it quickly. So you have an imager, which is basically this thing. I'm going to insult people if I say it looks like a Raspberry Pi camera on a fancy board. But that basically has a 40-meter resolution. So one pixel is, in reality, 40 meters big. 40 meters. And then you can take quite a cool array of images. We wanted it to go a bit fancier, so we bought an upgraded camera. This bigger camera also has a bigger lens. It's about the size of a 1U. So the lens is basically the entire deal for 1U. And then you get even nicer images because you have a bit more resolution. And then you can get to 5 meters per pixel. You need to do a lot of processing. This is what goes into one of those satellites. This is a 6-unit satellite, so 20 centimeters wide by 10 by 30. And then you stick that camera in there and a load of other boards. Most of it is related to power and communication, and of course computers, and a bit of propulsion to move it. And then we also put an LED on there. And you launch it, and then you get an image of it being launched. There it goes. And it's gone. That's the camera. That's not so important for now. And we also put an LED on there. We wanted to see, what if we turn on a really bright LED and somebody puts a telescope in that direction? And we did a lot of math, and we were like, okay, I think we can do it with these 12 extremely bright LEDs. Stick it on the board, make sure that we can turn it on, less than 10 watts power consumption, and we actually got somebody in Leiden who is quite famous in the tracking and astronomy sphere to point a telescope, and he actually took a picture and he saw the streak of the satellite, and when we turned on and off, we could actually see it turning on and off in his stacks of images. This is by Marco Langbroek. That QR code actually gets you to his blog post. It's also here in the bottom row. But if you want, you can scan that and have a look at the actual images. You can draw Morse code in the sky, and it has been done. We have drawn Morse code in the sky. This is awesome. I'm going to... Yes, Rick Roll from space. We have already had the plans of having a satellite transmit a Rick Roll, but that would violate so many laws, including copyright laws, that we can't. The data from this satellite, you get a thumbnail image, a smaller image of the data down, and then you can pick whether you want it or not, because you don't want to downlink stuff that you don't want. So you get a thumbnail, that, and then you get this in result. 500 kilobytes, 40 megabytes, San Francisco, El Paso, Juarez, and Australia as an example. And then you actually do data processing and you get the better camera on it. And now we come back to what I said earlier about overlaying data. You can get a raw image and start overlaying stuff. So RGB and perhaps a bit of infrared. And then you can start coloring in stuff and, for instance, say, oh, this is vegetation, or this is a typical industrial area. And you get pretty pictures out of it. This was done with a CubeSat. I overlaid that San Francisco image that was in the first slide here. So that's the black and white we got, and that's the processed image. And those are quite nice. This is done with a 6U, so half of this. Another pretty row of pictures. These are all oil wells. All these white dots are oil wells. So it's interesting to look at those from space and have a check if everything is still okay. And you can also zoom in and get a bit better view at something like a construction project or whatever, this Palm Island in Dubai. Unfortunately, we tried doing the zoom, rotate, and enhance from the movies, but you get a lot of tries, and sometimes it goes right. Most of the times, you get this kind of junk. You look at that airport over there, well, that wouldn't be safe to land because it's all wobbly. That's actually vibration in the satellite that made it wiggle a bit. So behind all these really pretty pictures are a ton of bad ones. How long does it take to grab one of those 40 megabyte images was the question. It depends a bit on which satellite you get. It can take up to 10 minutes. If we're on a backup link, it could take 2 days or 4 days. But normally, you can get it within what we call a pass, and you get way more than 40 megabytes down. You need to task stuff. So yeah, about 10 minutes of contact time will definitely get it in order. Yeah. Okay, the question was, where is the vibration coming from in the previous picture? I'll go back to the picture. There it is. Where's the vibration coming from? Well, you need to point the satellite somewhere, so you're moving it in space with you, because there's nothing to stop you from moving. You need to also stop it. And sometimes you overshoot a bit, and then you need to go a bit back, and then a bit forward. And in the meantime, you're going incredibly fast. So that, from that process internally, there's just a bit of shaking. And getting that algorithm right and pointing exactly the right place is quite a difficult task. And we're getting way better at it by doing it more often. So it's basically tuning all the constants to make sure that you can point somewhere and then stick to it. I'm aware of the time, so yes. I'm going to skip some of these slides. I just want to highlight one thing, which is emission monitoring, looking at greenhouse gases. And in this case, it's methane, which is also a big problem because there's these places where methane is produced that we're not really aware of. And there we actually have two satellites looking at the same thing from different angles, so we can calibrate out some of the cloud coverage over the place. This satellite is basically very impressive because we needed to fit an instrument in a CubeSat, and it contains a ton of mirrors. So it's basically, how can we shrink a big instrument into a CubeSat? Well, zigzag, get everything dimensionally right, fit it in, and build it. And then you get this, and this contains that instrument that used to be a 2 meter instrument that's now in a CubeSat. I'm gonna skip to the good bits here, which is, this is some sound that we captured from space. So this is a cruise ship telling, or a cruise ship being told where to moor in a harbor, captured from space with a satellite. So you...
If you can prepare one bow line, one stern line, and one stern line all on your starboard side, fenders up to your waterline as well. As you enter, you will pass your first entry on your port side. Right in front of you, you'll see a floating dock near to the Russian.
Yeah, we can go on, but this goes again, so we can go on. But that's basically capturing radio signals and then decoding them on Earth. So that decoding was done in our office, but the signals were captured by a satellite. So you can basically put a satellite over somewhere and just start capturing a bit of spectrum, what's happening there. and track stuff, track ships, because they're all sending, they're transmitting their location. And yeah, I'm out of time, and I'm also done because this is my last slide. Space is still hard.